Thank you for the invitation. Thank you, Luis and Avery, for the invitation to come here. So I will be talking about dynamical love numbers for Kerr black holes. So you probably have seen the title, at least, of love numbers in the literature. So I will be talking about those numbers a bit. And in particular, if you are not familiar with the meaning of these different items in the title, I will go through, so don't get distracted with that, and discuss a bit what happens with the Kerr black holes. Let me say that I didn't put the love numbers because we are very close to St. Valentine's. It's just, it's the name we give these numbers for the black holes. So before I start, however, on this, let me tell you a bit about James Bardeen and Perimeter. So every time I come to Perimeter, and I have been coming here since I was a grad student, I think the first time in 2006 or so, the building has been growing, people has changed and everything. But one of the things that happened to me exactly in this room was 8 years ago when I was giving a talk about black hole jets and near horizons of extremal black holes. And I was looking for faculty positions at that time. And I referenced a paper of the near horizon extremal Kerr black hole. And I went and said, this is by the original limit was found by Horowitz and someone else that I don't remember. And of course, someone very politely at, around here was sitting and raised his hand, a senior person raised his hand and said, well, the other person, it's me, I'm Bardeen. So I have to come back in honor of James Bardeen and say that it was a great, colleague at that time. It didn't ruin my career. And so that's the link I have with Perimeter. And when I was coming back, I remembered that anecdote, which is recorded, of course. And so I wanted to mention that. Okay, so what are we going to do today? I want to tell you a bit about what I have been kind of thinking about, but this is going to be the outline of my talk to give you a bit of the motivation of why these love numbers or these numbers that describe these black holes that are going to be deformed in some way are seen in other areas, not just the black holes. And I will review one of the first kind of discussions that started to getting me interested in the topic, which is about the static love numbers versus the dynamical love numbers, which is what I've worked on. Yes, I'm not going to go very deep into that, but I would just use the definitions as an excuse to kind of tell you a review of where we are currently in trying to understand these problems in here. And there are two different proposals. One here is Adam Innit, which is the second one, for explaining why these static love numbers are going to be very interesting and becoming zero for black holes. And then I will tell you what we know now about computing dynamical love numbers. And this is, I did work with Malcolm Perry at Cambridge. So that is what my talk is going to be about. Okay, so the talk is basically about something that we are very familiar with, that it's called tidal deformations. So what are tidal deformations? We are very familiar. When we are very little, we see the waves in the ocean. Part of it has to do with the proximity of the Earth towards in the vicinity of the moon. And so that deforms the bulge of our oceans, which creates these differences, yes? So the moon gravitational pulls on the ocean, and so it deforms the shape of our Earth as well, not just the ocean, but the effects in the fluid part in the oceans creates the tides. So This is a gravitational phenomena, which is what we are going to be looking at as well, that causes bodies to stretch along the line that connects them, pointing towards and away from the center of mass of the bodies. And so in this, you've probably seen it maybe in high school, middle school. This is what we are going to be doing now next for black holes. But before doing that, let me show you a bit that some of the consequences, as we learned in many, many years of studies. So tidal deformations are so big that they actually deform also the objects in our planets and in our solar system. So one of the examples that you can, if you start searching about the topic, that I found very interesting is the Jupiter-Io tidal interaction. So Io is one of the moons in Jupiter, and the deformation is so big that it corrects the way the orbits that the moon is doing. And as well, these tidal deformations make the planet squeeze. And so we think that they're also part of the reasons of why they have volcanic eruptions. If a planet is deformed and they have a liquid core, then you're squeezing them out. And so through the pores or the breaks, they start having volcanic eruptions. So the tidal effects are very important in the solar system to understand the phenomena. But now we have been able to even go further. And what you see here is the an American football-shaped moon, if you want, of a hot star. This is a measurement by the European Space Agency from last year. So we have been able to detect tidal deformations in exoplanets, not just in our solar system, which I found to be sort of very interesting that we can do that. And tidal deformations appear also as we, so this is a Hubble Space Telescope of these two galaxies here. You can see one galaxy approaching the other one. And so they are tidally deformed by being just close to each other. So the effects of gravity at long distances as well in the galactic motion. So the significance of the effects is part of the interesting part as well on trying to understand the tidal deformations, because they can tell us things about the internal composition of the objects that are affected, and they undergo different deformations. As so in the US, I live in a city similar size as Waterloo in Utah, and so farms are very, you know, so every year there's a squash type of, you know, event. And so you can see that the squashes that are a little bit less, you know, round or empty, if you want, you can squish them a lot more, and gravity does that effect on the bigger squashes. So my analogy now is going to be between squashes and black holes. So, okay. So what is the problem going to be, and where in, you know, the problems of black holes, I think this tidal deformations will become interesting. So one of the cases of tidal deformations would be in binary black hole systems, where you have the black hole that is not solely a black hole, a Kerr black hole isolated, but it has a companion that is big enough to create an external gravitational field that will deform the shape of your black hole. So that's the image that you see here. So we have a black hole and an external field that doesn't have to be exactly another black hole, but a very strong external gravitational field that can be a compact object that generates that field where the black hole, the larger black hole, or the object that we are studying, gets affected. Now, black holes are different to the images that I showed you. They do have event horizons. And from a theoretical perspective, black holes are made out of nothing. So they're simply these boundaries in space-time. So why would it be possible to really distort, tidally distort a black hole, if that is really something that can happen? So I set up here a few questions. So one of the things, you know, that when all these papers started to come out about love numbers and tidal deformations of black holes, I started to try to understand the literature a bit and started to become interested in the topic is about, you know, the effects of this. How can this really be happening with objects that don't really are made out in principle of matter per se? How can we really characterize them? How can we characterize the tidal deformations for the black holes? Can we explain this as a universal feature, saying, you know, oh, we have tidal deformations, we have this definition, does that give us a fingerprint for what they mean? And universally, meaning other theories of general relativity, extensions of it, or higher dimensions, and what can we learn from those tidal deformations? In particular, is there a way to see the reflection of these tidal deformations on, say, gravitational wave signals? Yes? Okay, so I am not answering all those questions. Those are part of the motivations of things I started to be interested in. So one thing in which numerical relativity is always you know, a step ahead now of the theoretical physicists, where all these studies of event horizons and deformations of black holes in binary systems. And one of the papers that show how the event horizons get deformed as the binary black hole merger starts happening is this paper by Tolkowski and others, and there may be a lot of the others. It's just that they have the pictures of the event horizons, and so it makes my life easier if I put those instead of the apparent horizon. So here's one. They painted it yellow, the black holes, but you know, I always assume they should be black. But and here they decided on an orange coloring. So the difference is there's a binary system that is going around in the typical orbital composition of the merger, and here this is the difference is that this is a front collision on one of the lines, and you have the event horizons that are going to be deformed and then become just one single object. So the effects that, or the numbers that we are going to be looking at now analytically are not going to be in this very extreme case where the object is totally deformed, or in this cases over here, we are going to see an in-between step where the black holes are becoming closer to each other and start to become and feel the external field of the other object. And the reason for that is you need a deformation that is so that there's a deformation, but we can then extract these numbers, making some sense of them as being describing something, something that is defined at least uniformly for any object in a background like that. So there would be some ways, perhaps, in describing what the deformations are for these objects, but I don't want to discuss those. I'm going to do a problem more like the pictures I showed you before of my binary system that is a bit more separate than this regime. One of the applications of the tidal love numbers in general, and not in particular for black holes, has to do also with the neutron stars. So one of the ideas of trying to study these tidal love numbers that show up then in the gravitational waveforms is that if we start measuring or knowing what those tidal deformations are in the gravitational waves, we could, in principle, start understanding better what the neutron stars are, for example, or distinguish a black hole from another object. That is kind of the idea in some sense, and I'm not going to work on the gravitational wave sides, but I'm going to show you a bit how on the theoretical side we describe these coefficients. So the tidal deformations that we are aware of, or we know in kind of more Newtonian way of defining them for the stars, and this is how Love, who was a mathematician in Oxford at the beginning of the 20th century, and that's where the name comes from, was thinking that there should be a way to characterize the deformations in the Earth and in the planets for a tidal deformation that should be a dimensionless parameter that could assess or give us an idea of the internal structure of the black holes. And the way to do that in Newtonian way would be to do a multiple decomposition of the multiples of the mass decomposition of the object. So you would have, if you have a potential, some point particle potential that's the mass of the black hole, and the other multiples in your expansion would have a structure like this, where in this type of decomposition, these numbers, these KLMs, are going to measure the tidal effects or the reaction of the body against an external gravitational field. This is basically what you can see in the Newtonian description for these objects. And so here there's some sizes and some details about what the different scales are here. But the point is that in the way that we can do these computations in Newtonian physics, we should be able to also define these numbers in general relativity. There are a lot of problems when you do that, because some of the definitions of what these multiples are is not so clear, it depends basically on the coordinate systems, but there are some ways in which we have encountered an independent, coordinate-independent way or covariant way in describing them. And so that is kind of where we are at. So I think I have one slide that says something more about that. But so how can we understand what those gravitational potentials, how do they enter the problem in this case of general relativity? So here have a metric, which is going to be the metric that I want to write for a tidally deformed black hole. And what we can do is, and I set up here Minkowski, but you should think about any other object, say you start with Schwarzschild or Kerr black hole, and you want to add a small perturbation to it and solve Einstein's equations in such a way at linear level that you deform the original geometry to be able to say something about the perturbations that are felt as a reaction of being embedded in an external field. And if we linearize Einstein's equations, when you have a small perturbation like this and picking some intelligent choices of gauges, in the end, we end up with a more simpler equation for the Einstein's equations that we need to solve, in which we have to solve for the linear perturbations in them. So instead of doing the whole perturbation problem, most of the papers have focused lately on one of the equations that come up from this linearized Einstein's equations and the perturbation problem, which has to do with analyzing basically the scalar in the background of your favorite black hole that you want to distort. And the connection between that is that the TT component of that perturbation that you're looking at is related to the typical problem of the scalar in this way by -1/2. So when you start reading the papers, it was very confusing to me at the beginning of why there were, you know, all the tidal deformation papers started with a scalar equation. It didn't make sense to me. And this is one of the reasons why people are just looking at the Laplacian in curved backgrounds for the scalar. So it will have a meaning in the deformation of your geometry per se.
Can I just ask one?
Yes.
So this is a description of HTT for an isolated body that's being deformed. So should that be R to the minus L out front? I mean, because
R to the minus here?
There's an R to the L and there's an R to the minus L solution, right?
Yes.
And the one that you adopt in vacuum far away, wouldn't that be the R to the minus L solution? Because it's the one that decays.
This one, exactly. So this is going to be the deformation of the body itself. Yes. And this is, will represent your external field. Yeah.
Okay. I'm just trying to understand how the way that that expansion is written, how to interpret ELM. Because if I were doing an expansion outside of the star, say, I would make the coefficients of R to the L all be zero. And I'd be looking at the R to the minus L plus one terms, which would be...
To describe, you mean the geometry?
To the gravitational potential outside.
Is the tidal field, I thought, is this epsilon, or is this E, L, M?
Yeah, the tidal field of the decay in terms of the response is not asymptotic.
I see. Okay.
No.
Okay.
Right.
Got it.
Exactly. Okay, so what that means for the typical, general relativity class is that we could, in principle, start thinking not of Kerr black holes anymore, but Kerr that are characterized with a parameter m and the spin, but mostly now we could think of solutions of Einstein's equations for these tightly deformed Kerr black holes. And in that, we should have some additional parameters, these KLMs that will characterize the different types of deformations that we are going to build for the solutions of Einstein's equations. So what is more concretely the problem? And the reason is that I put a bit of the kind of parameters in here is to show you then what we do with the dynamical problem. So we want to find solutions of the scalar equation in these curved backgrounds. And one thing that we have known now for 40 years or so is that we can reduce the problem as something that we can split or have different equations for, in which the scalar can take this different products of functions in the t, phi, r, and theta components or variables and have independent or decoupled equations. And in particular, what we are going to be looking at, and not mostly the spherical part because we know how to solve those equations in certain regimes, is to look at the radial equation in that. And besides trying to solve the wave equation, we are going to be setting up some boundary conditions. So for a black hole, the boundary conditions on the horizon should be the ones that we would expect, in particular the ones that are only ingoing at the horizon. So no outgoing flux coming out from the horizon. So when we have a solution, we will try to find a solution that is smooth on the horizon and has this form in here, where there's a coefficient that is this alpha plus. It's something called the monodromy of the expansion in mathematical terms. But basically, there's a coefficient here, a power that has dependence on different values. Mostly, it depends. So T plus is going to be your Bekenstein-Hawking or the Hawking temperature, and then omega is going to be the angular velocity of your black hole. So it will depend on A and the spin and the mass parameter. Here you can rewrite them as the inner and outer horizons, but it's just a way of reparametrizing the values of M and A in there. The coefficients here depend on omega and M, which are these two eigenvalues of the temporal and azimuthal directions of the scalars. So after you fixed your boundary conditions once in and solve the equation, what you do once you have the conditions on the horizon, you perform an analytical continuation of the solution to infinity. That's where your observer is going to be looking at the problem. And so in there, you can then analyze the structure of the radial equation and analyze a structure of this form that is similar to what I've shown before, and identify in the way the follows of the functions are written in that case what the love numbers are in these definitions, these KLMs.
Right, can I ask you?
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? So here you have a second order equation.
There's not going to be two boundary conditions to define the so for quasi-normal modes, for example, we set up boundary conditions on the horizon.
Suppose I'm looking at the static case. So I'm not on omega.
Yeah, so that's smoothness on the horizon.
That's one.
Yes, and then you go to infinity, and the KLMs are a ratio of one and the other one. So
C1 would be the boundary condition, it would be the tidal guy, and this gives you some C1.
Right.
And then you have the ratio. So what is the horizon you have?
No, so the ratio is the only that's not. But it still needs to be two boundary conditions. One may be right on because I'm going to be taking the ratio.
Yeah. Regulating the horizon and C1 at infinity or something like that. C1 tells you something about phase zero of the tidal guy.
But for identifying the love number in...
No, that I understand.
Exactly.
That's
exactly. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the so this is schematically what the problem is and the definitions for these tidal love numbers. So the... Yes.
Maybe one qualitative question to follow up on that. So I ended... Now I understand this... Is the is the tidal field plus the
deformation? Right.
Good. It's a little weird, you know, practically to think of the tidal field extending, you know, as a gradient all the way out to
infinity. Right? It doesn't.
Right. So what happens if you truncate that at some finite radius? Is that going to impose a very different set of boundary conditions? I mean, naively you might think it wouldn't, but.
The way I see it is the other way around. So this would be the limit if you have a disk, say in more astro terms, where the limit of that source is. And then to go all the way to infinity, you should paste, some other solution that goes to asymptotically flat.
But all your solutions are solutions that are asymptotically the tidal distortion, right?
Yes.
Okay. So maybe the answer is it is obvious that the edge of the region that you're going to treat as the tidal field at off to infinity is not terribly important.
No.
Okay.
Most of the problems in which you want to test the tidal deformation, you really have to be so the important coefficients in the problem are within the region that one defines as a solution where the solution, the problem is set up, and will not depend on the characteristics of what the asymptotic is in say, whether you're in, say, some other external field or so for defining this coefficient. Yeah, do you have a question over there? Okay, so one thing I found very confusing was the distinction between tidal love numbers and then there were static love numbers, dynamical love numbers, something they called the love numbers, and dissipative tidal things. So this is what I'm going to kind of tell you what I'm going to use as part of the definition. So part of the problem that we set up was in general in the last transparency, where we had this omega that was floating there that tells you whether the field is dynamic or static, Okay, so most of the problems that we have been able to solve analytically and completely in closed, say, analytical form were the ones for static Love numbers. So what you do in the problem, you take the equations I showed you before and take omega equals to zero. And in there, we can solve the problem. It becomes a problem in the Kerr black hole of hypergeometric functions. And so we can compute exactly what the static Love numbers are for a black hole. This means that by doing this, the external gravitational field has no dynamics. It would be a static external field, but we can see what the reaction of the black hole is. So one of the interesting things that started to pop up was that, in fact, when this happens, the black hole's Love numbers, those KLMs, were zero for black holes. And whenever there's a zero in, you know, this means the black hole doesn't like to be deformed if you put him in an external field. One of the, you know, interesting things that happens in physics is that you want to understand why that is that you get zeros for the black holes. And so there were questions about what happens. You know, do every single object that has an event horizon in any of the theories actually give you that when they are set up in a static environment, they would not react to gravitational deformations or not? So the story was interesting in trying to understand why, explaining why, what could be this mean for gravitational waves, and what happens with other alternative theories in this case. But before doing that, there was a big discussion among three different groups that were saying they are zero, and some of the papers were saying, no, they were not zero. So we understood now that they were not the best ways of defining them just because they were defined in different frames or coordinate frames. And we set up now the competition in a different way, in which this coordinate, in a coordinate more invariant way. And that was fixed, that was the first step. So the static Love numbers are zero for Kerr black holes. And one of the things that came later, maybe 2 years ago or so, was the explanation of why the static Love numbers could be zero. And one of the ideas behind it is symmetries, as you could have, you know, imagined that when, you know, you have zeros in gravity or in theory, you have those problems. So one of the things I was interested in last year when we've met with Malcolm was the idea of the dynamical black holes. So this is my video. You know, the EHT wants to do videos of things a lot. They have all these images. Well, this is the best thing I could come up with as a theoretical physicist. So the question was, what happens if the field is now not static but dynamical? And so the problem, even though it's just setting one of the parameters, omega to zero, not zero, from the math perspective, this breaks the bank, meaning the way we solve that very simple equation that I showed, or maybe I didn't show and I will show now, becomes something called a confluent Hoyne equation. And if you've ever worked in quasi-normal modes or gray body factors, you will see that there are all these numerics going on in trying to find what the quasi-normal modes are. Basically, here we would have the same problem. Basically, the problem is that from the math standpoint, there are other effects when omega is not equals to zero, and we can't solve analytically the equation. We would have to go to solve it numerically, which is not a problem. But if we want to continue looking at symmetries and maybe other effects, it would make more sense to try to find some of the structure analytically. And so this is why we were interested in seeing what happens. Okay. That's the first comment about static and dynamical things or differences that I wanted to make. The other thing that I felt in the literature was very confusing was the statements of the Love numbers being zero. And when I looked at the papers, they weren't zero. They had an imaginary part. So I couldn't understand what it was. Well, the thing that and maybe you said it somewhere, Adam, and people, but I was reading, you know, already a lot of the literature to get to that.
Confused.
I was very confused. So the KLMs, these parameters are complex. They do not need to be real when you solve the equation. And so there are two parts of it. There's the real part and some part that is or is defined as the imaginary part of that. And the conservative part, the real part, is going to be actually the tidal deformation, the Love number, yes? And this other bit here is going to be your dissipative effect. So another type of deformation in the same way that we have or define, for example, susceptibilities for magnetic objects. So that is the difference. So what we did in order to not impose anything is that in general, I would refer to the KLMs as the tidal deformations of black holes. Some people call these KLMs the Love numbers in general, but most people would call the Love numbers just the real part of the KLMs, okay? So why is this, is my point in this distinction, is that when you look at, you know, how the static Love numbers are found, or you do the computation and find, you see that the static Love numbers, the static part of that tidal deformation is zero. And it's not zero because they're canceling of things. It's basically because the deformations, the KLMs, are purely imaginary numbers. So for Kerr black holes, the Love number, the real part of those KLMs vanishes, but there's an imaginary part that has this more complicated form, even for static Love numbers, yes, for the static case. So there is a part that doesn't vanish of the KLMs, but it's purely imaginary, and that is how it looks like. And I posted it here so that you can see what the type of structures we have. This gamma here is just a rewriting of the parameters of A over the square root of m squared minus a squared. Here you see the ratios of the radius of the black hole that depend also on m and l, m and a. And the l's here have to do with the eigenvalues of the spheroidal part of the coupling in the problem. Okay, so those are there. S is, we took the equation and the scalar is S equals to zero for when we treat a massless scalar, but you could take, that's the spin of the particle that you're choosing. So for the gravitational case, you would choose S equals to two. But in, you know, theoretical physics, whenever we see an equation, we get excited, oh, we can just, you know, do this more general. So you will see the examples are, you know, others, but the ones that correspond to the gravitational deformation in the geometry will be the S equals to two cases in there.
So my question is, if I do a positive expansion,
yeah, that's...
If I can go on some way, so I know the KLA enter, but yeah, what are these guys?
They do enter at that order. Those are the ones. 4.5, depending on whenever.
The
static dissipation starts at that order, and depending of, I think it's, I don't know in which it's, I think it's 4.5, what you call fifth order. They will show up, the zeros.
The zeros?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm asking all the others, the non-zero.
The non-zero ones come earlier. They come at 2 point something for the rotating black holes, as far as I can remember about that. We can look it up exactly.
So here you're squashing value, or what you're saying is you could have done a much better assessment of the equation state of Venus number.
Exactly.
Yeah. 2.5 the order.
Right. I don't know what exactly. I don't remember, Luis, the definitions for the orders. I know this ones here show much earlier, and I think it's two second order, if I remember well, and the other ones are, the Love numbers are going to be higher up. So there is, so I'm going to do then the dynamical problem. So this is what happens at the static. The reason why I'm showing you the expressions for the static case is that we'll see that for the dynamical problem, they start showing up. The zeroth order is recursive in some way. It shows up always as being proportional to the dynamical of numbers. And that's why I thought it was good to have what those expressions are in here. A comment related to post-Newtonian, there's a discussion about, say, Eric Poisson's papers and, you know, all the other, there seems to be a mismatch. So what the definition, so currently there are some Love numbers that are in the post-Newtonian approximation zero, which we don't get as being zero. And there are some dependents that are log dependent, and I'll show you exactly where, that in the post-Newtonian approximation, they are not log dependent. So there's a discrepancy between the, or a discussion if you want. No one has checked or understands what the link is. Our work is not the only one of these dynamical love numbers that I will show you. There are some other ways of looking at the tidal deformations, which involves the effective field theory description. That is a much larger, you know, area, which has a lot more structure. It is mostly coordinate independent. And in that way of also computing the tidal deformations, they obtain the things that we are obtaining and not recovering exactly what's being computed at the post-Newtonian level.
Right. The rest, it's going to show off the
We can look it up exactly. I don't remember exactly, but in some cases we can see them directly in the gravitational.
In some cases, we don't even understand. I don't know if we understand what these like running these lot dependent static responses would look like observation from these Thomas Mars like.
Can I ask, what does it mean for this to be a dissipation coefficient in the static case?
So I have a piece of intuition from things like tidal locking of planets. You raise a tide.
Yeah.
But because of viscosity or stresses in the crust, it lags. Mm-hmm. That lagging would show up in this formalism as an imaginary component.
Yeah.
Phase shift and phi. Yeah. And that lag then pulls back on the original field, right? So that's where the tidal dissipation comes from.
Yeah.
But that's predicated on this idea of the tidal, the source of the tide marching around and you're lagging behind it. And if it was just static, then what is
the way, I am, if you want, overstating that would correspond to dissipation in that it's not omega dependent, it's not time dependent. The reason why I extrapolated the way we are going to call that dissipative is because I, you know, was looking at the dynamical problem and not that. So it may not really apply in this case in the same way that when you show the boundary conditions on the event horizon, it's not ingoing on the horizon because there's no going anywhere. It's just smoothness across the horizon. It's not omega dependent. So in that respect, this is what I think about the term. Now, about the tidal locking, I don't think the effects will be enough to tidal lock black holes, maybe.
I'm just using my analogy.
And one of the most famous, you know, examples that I heard about was the Jupiter Io locking of things.
I thought that since it's only for rotating black holes, you have the dissipation that it's the rotational energy that's dissipated by the tidal deformation. Because, like, I think the potential is time dependent, right? The space time isn't.
Yes.
That is stationary, right? Mm-hmm. So, I thought that was dissipated would be the rotational energy, right?
Well, in the case of like the planetary analogy, I mean, there's a lot of hot Jupiters that are tidal locked as well. And it's exactly the rotation of Jupiter that's being dissipated.
I mean, I know that papers by Dubrovsky and people, they have a, they have exactly, they tell you the analogy to where the dissipation stuff comes from, so it's probably quite similar to the Newtonian exhibition.
And the rotation of the Earth, actually, as we're going to all find out on the plane. All right, go on.
Okay, so do I have 1 hour or 50 minutes? Have you been taking your time? Okay, good. Just okay, good, good. I'm okay. Okay, so just one plot. I like the equations, but I need kind of you know, some idea of what those KLMs. This is always static. So the only thing I wanted to show is that this coefficients, the imaginary bit, because the other part, the Love number per se, is zero. But when you fix the mass of the black hole to one, so I'm setting all the other scales to one as well, you can increase the spin parameter. And so this KLM's, the imaginary part, becomes larger for larger spins. Okay, so this is the coloring here. This would be zero A spin parameter and so on. And so you increase. And as you increase the value of L in the multiple expansion, this kind of shrinks down to whatever it is, but there's no crossing of those KLMs. This will change in higher dimensions, and that's why I had this plot, and I will not go there, but I just wanted to kind of say that there are some way of some patterns that these KLMs are capturing in relation to the parameters they have. Okay, so I mentioned effective field theory. My talk is not about effective field theory descriptions, but let me just pop here some of the information about the reason or why we think that there's some symmetry arguments that could lead to understanding why the Love numbers are zero. There are different proposals that state that basically what happens is not at the level of the geometry, but at the level of the equation that we are analyzing, that there is some hidden symmetry, hidden in the way that it's the symmetry not of the geometry, but the equation that we are looking at, in particular in this case is the Laplacian. So if we have an SL2R cross U1 symmetry, and some papers refer to as the Love symmetry, that could explain the reason of why this Love numbers or the real part becomes zero for the static case. And there's a different proposal that Adam and others also looked at, which is proposing that there's an SO4,2 type of symmetry, and that it gives rise to the symmetry in that case, and then the zeros of the Love number. So I'm not going. You can invite Adam to give a talk if he hasn't yet. Okay, good. So I'm not going to take over that. The only reason why I say that is that asymmetries are important in these equations and in this problem. I am going to propose for the extension to the dynamical Love numbers a different type of symmetry. So it will not be realized in explaining the zero, the static case, but I think it is important for the dynamical case. And the reason why we started thinking about is that the first thing you could think about is to say, okay, let us impose further this symmetry that works in the static case and try to solve the dynamical problem. Well, if we do that, the thing is that it doesn't really work in the sense that we can get some KLMs in there that depend on omega in that way. But we know it doesn't really give the low frequency regime of those KLMs. So there was in the literature when we started looking at this, papers that were based on previous matched asymptotic expansions of the problem for the low frequency, and then Dubovsky et al. Found what the KLMs to low frequency should be. Okay, so this is the dependence when the frequency is very low in the Love numbers. So the extension of the ideas of these symmetries to higher dimensions, as you can, you know, by comparison look at them, they don't have, the KLMs don't have this ratio of gammas that you see popping up in comparison with the ones that you would find with the other problems in there. So that was part of the idea that we had with Malcolm. And so we were wondering, I talked about already about the discussion. So we thought, okay, let's do something else in holography or in CARE CFT, or if there are reasons that we don't know really why in string theory. We were fixated by it in the 90s as well, and recently in the theory community because of conformal field theories. Let's create or just go to a regime in the equation that we want to solve, which is the same equation for the scalar that I was talking. I didn't do much, but I fixed the symmetry to be an SL2R times U1, SL2R times SL2R symmetry. So basically the way this you know, is done is you have the equations that are separate equations from the scalar problem. You get the radial and the spheroidal part. This KLS is the coupling constant, if you want, the KLMs that are, this is a coupled system of equations. You have this spheroidal equation. And to get the hidden symmetries, what you do is you go to a regime where some of the terms in the radial equation basically drop out. Yes? So that's how the hidden symmetry shows up in the equation. And so what we looked up is solving the first equation mostly in this regime and the second equation for the problem with the hidden symmetries there. And so what we did, and the way you do it, you can find it in the paper, is you kind of construct the equation, make it some coordinate transformations, identify some parameters. This A and B here should be this ones as well. And in the end, this is the kind of part that I was talking about before. Is we set up some, so we have two solutions, your C1 solution and your C2 solution. You choose the ones that are ingoing on the horizon, so you kill one of the solutions to the differential equation and make an analytical continuation by doing that. You can then identify the value of the left numbers. And so if we put everything together, and this is why I showed the transparency in the middle, you get this, okay? So MS, a whole big equation in here. What ends up happening is that that coefficient there with this ratio of the omegas is exactly the one that was found by the matched asymptotic expansion to low frequencies. And so it seems that, you know, our way of thinking about these hidden symmetries that is not, you know, that is different, is actually recovering in some way a very, you know, a problem that can be solved also analytically, but without any symmetry kind of arguments.
So here you are in the low frequency regime.
Yes. So in the low frequency regime, exactly. So you take the KLMs and then you do an expansion in low frequency. So I labeled here, you can't perhaps see it, but so you have one as being the first order in omega, and these twos belong to the real and the imaginary part to second order. And that's kind of, you could go on, but doesn't make too much sense later on. But what I wanted to show you in the low frequency regime.
Sorry, but your equations already enforced in low frequency regime. So here you're using it again. Because you, one of the things you asked for simplifying your equation of motion was m times omega being much more than one.
Correct.
So that already fixes in low frequency regime.
Yes, yes. So the order of the fixing is to omega squared. And that's where we kind of look and compare to. Yeah? So what I just wanted to mention here is that when we go kind of in orders, there's a pattern. So the green bubble there shows the zeros, the static love number, the dissipative part. So, and you can see that they all start becoming proportional to the zeroth order one. And so there's kind of sort of like a tower of things that become more complicated as you, but there's some structure in the definitions from zero to up orders. So that's as far as I want to show more about it. And the other here difference, if you want, or information, is that we were trying to understand what happens with the post-Newtonian approximations. So one of the things that we can do directly is to take the case of S equals to 2 for Schwarzschild. The post-Newtonian approximation has been computed. In the way we are doing things and these low frequency regimes and the EFT, this effective field theory stories, we get that this order of the Love numbers are omega squared and log dependent in R. These are not showing up apparently in the post-Newtonian computations. It could be that there's some way of matching things up if we understand better and maybe start discussions about how we are defining things and, you know, things that are defined to post-Newtonian approximations. But that is the comment there. Inspired by the symmetries, here what I did was to just write part of these Love numbers in terms of CFT, terms of right and left moving things. This is not relevant for now. They have, these expressions have contact with some other theories called N equals 2 supergravities, where we are not in the low frequency regime anymore, but that's another thing I'm not discussing. We can simply extend all the definitions, and this is why we picked R plus and R minus in the descriptions. So the only thing, if you want to extend to objects that are not care but are tau not or some modified kind of other objects, is you would replace your R plus R minus with the corresponding values of your inner and outer horizons to extend that, and the Love numbers would be the same kind of form, but with that parameters there extended in that case. And there's a whole other story with what happens in higher dimensions. And so we started looking at it with Adam and Luca, and now we are looking at things also with Austin Joyce, of what happens with these Love numbers definitions. There is already things in the literature, but we have been this is an advertisement for a future paper of ours. So anyways, that is what I wanted to tell you about those things. So let me conclude now. So in the outline, I promised a few things. I think I did all of those in telling you a bit of reviewing the topic and trying to clarify or at least my confusions when I started looking at the problems a year ago, and offered some ways of understanding the computations, and mostly guided in this analytical story by these symmetries, hidden symmetries in the problem. But most importantly, that I convinced you that black holes are like squashes. So, okay, thank you.
We have time for some questions, hopefully from, yes?
So, Tara, can you tell me how SL to R symmetries?
Say that again, that SL?
How to see this SL to R
in the equation? Oh, yeah. So what you do is you write, so you need to do a computation. I can tell you in words what you should do. We can look it up if you want, but it's not something that I will be here be doing for you in, where is the equation?
The fact that I have a geometric function means I have a lot of SL2, right? I don't know how to see the other perspective.
It's sufficient, right?
Yeah.
Well, no, write the equation of motion is hypergeometric.
So,
that has as SL2
representations. So there's something that we know that when we find the solutions to an equation, if they are hypergeometric functions, they have at least part of the symmetry is that they have what's called an SL2R symmetry. So this is what Adam was saying. Now, how do you see here the two SL2Rs? The way you do this is you have to write the operators, some operators. So you rewrite your differential operator as a product of other operators. And those operators are going to show you that they kind of have the rules of your algebra that you're, so they will close in SL2Rs. And those, there are two SL2R sectors that are non-commuting with each other. We can look at, I can show you in some older papers where that's done, and that's the way to do it. So if you try to do the same thing with, say, the equations that Adam has in his paper, you will see that actually you need some other ways of writing your second order operator there, and those will have this other hidden symmetry in comparison to that. Yes?
Can I follow up on that? I thought the SL2 cross SL2 is only well defined when A is not zero, and then for Schwarzschild.
No, for Schwarzschild it's not.
Like there's not maybe a Schwarzschild limit.
No.
So what does that apply into your story?
Yes.
So you have a well defined Schwarzschild limit for your results, right?
Yes. So at the level of the symmetry for that, we can, in principle, not enforce the symmetry for the A equals to zero. But what we did was, you know, we cheated mathematically in the same way that, you know, we are doing this not in an ineffective. So you can still take the A equals to zero limit and see whether that matches the zero love number computation, and it does. So it's not an honest computation because we know that the SL2R, so the discussion is the following. This SL2R times SL2R hidden symmetry, if we take A equals to zero, there are things that don't work out. So if we go to the Schwarzschild limit, we couldn't, one does not, you know, one cannot go to the Schwarzschild limit. But I showed you some comparisons with what we think is going to happen at the post-Newtonian level that is sort of illegal because it doesn't have the symmetry. But the parameters are scalars. So we thought we were fine in, however, taking the A equals to zero limit just as a test to see the comparison with the low frequency, you know, regimes and the post-Newtonian approximations.
So basically you use the symmetry to get an answer, then the answer has a good Schwarzschild limit, right?
Right, but if we had looked at the equation, I think we would be in trouble. But because we were looking at the values of the scalars, we should be okay, if that makes sense.
All right, last question, Luis.
Quick question. So when you pointed out that this log term that you guys see that the post-Newtonian doesn't have, and then maybe as well, maybe how you define things, but why is it not possible that you're solving a different problem? By taking this particular limit, there are things that you're throwing away. Why do you know that those things that you've thrown away will not come in and remove the log, for instance?
I agree with that, but there's a completely independent problem with a matched asymptotic expansion that I wasn't involved in. It's Dubovsky et al. Based on the other, and they get the same low frequency and the log terms that we get. And from that computation there. Then on top of that, there's a different computation that has to do with effective field theories that is a world different computation. I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with approximations and so on. And when they do the low frequency approximation, they get the dynamical love numbers that these other computations that do. And it's not only that we are getting some log terms, there are some love numbers that are not there in the post-Newtonian approximation. So some zeros in the post-Newtonian approximation that are not in ours. And I think there's, I mean, it's not that one is wrong and the other is right. I think it's just the way we are defining things, but we need to clarify that because we have the questions from the post-Newtonian, you know, we as not me, my paper only, like from all these things, and there's also all the literature on post-Newtonian. So there's something here that we need to figure out and needs to be looked at.
All right, so
let me say one last word. You know, we're talking about tidal effects, but you know, tidal effects are happening right now, and in fact, in addition to the tides in the oceans, tidal effects are slowing the rotation of the Earth down. So today's getting progressively longer, and that energy goes somewhere. It goes into the moon. So April 8th is not your last chance to see a total solar eclipse, but it's one of your last chances. There will be a time when they all become annular eclipses for exactly the physical reasons we're talking about here applied to planets. So let's thank Maria again.
Thank you.